I hope you can hear me okay. As Ivan said, I'm an artist, so I'm not going to be reading a paper. I'm going to be talking alongside images. I've got a PowerPoint, and I'm going to show you examples. So what I'm going to talk about is lovers, examples of artists who are partners, and how they work, and artworks that make use of love as a subject. So, first of all, I thought I'd show you an image of one of my own works, and this is one of my paintings. I finished it yesterday, so you're the first people to see it. And it's by 150 centimetres, so you get a sense of it being large, like maybe the scale of, say, a carpet or something. Anyway, large and decorative. And there are images which are based on my own memories of the end of a relationship, where one of the images lying in bed, and then there's a kind of another me that's getting up to run away, and then one of the images looking out of a window. And there's text which is from Neruda, a Neruda poem, which is thinking tangling shadows, and the poem talks about a kind of a loving call, like calling out, and also it talks about freeing, dissolving images, freeing birds, a kind of freedom and unpacking that goes with loving and longing. So anyway, this is a piece of work by Felix Gonzalez Torres, and there's two clocks, and they're set at exactly the same time. And over time, one of them inevitably loses sync with the other one. So there's this idea that two things that are meant to be operating at the same time kind of lose step with each other. And it's called Perfect Lovers. And in a way, it's an example of how the subject of love in artwork becomes a subject which can be conceptualized, which may have a metaphoric, active metaphor within it. But the fact is that it's distanced from a real experience. It's not about the artist writing about their own love or their own relationship or making work about their own relationship. It's about a kind of universality. And I wanted to quote Alain Badiou from his book In Praise of Love, in saying, "The seed of universality resides in the impulse towards love. The impulse of love is an impulse towards something Plato calls the idea." And I can't help thinking of these two ideas as a way of saying that love is generative. And for an artist, I think there's an impulse to do, to act, to think, to make. And that I think love can drive a type of generation. I think what artists give to their work can be this relationship between themselves and the other, which can be quite like a sort of loving relationship. So what I'm going to talk about now is an example of an exhibition which was at Pippi Holdsworth Gallery in 2012, which was called Sweethearts, and it was artists who are partners working in collaboration. And the thing about them is that they aren't artists who usually work in collaboration, so they made work especially for the show. So here we've got Rosa Loy and Neo Rauch, who are two German painters from the Leipzig School, who made a painting together, and Rosa Loy's painting is on the left-hand side and Neo Rauch's on the right-hand side. And I have to say, as an aside, that many of these artist couples were imbalanced because one is much more successful than the other, and often the man is much more successful than the woman. But these are a couple of painters who Neo Rauch is a hugely successful German painter, and Rosa Loy is an equally talented partner who isn't as well known. But the piece of work is, I don't speak German, so this is a German word to pronounce probably quite badly. Yeah? You can help me with it. Well, I have to find it first. Die Jagd Gesellschaft. The Jagd Gieselschaft. No, okay. I think in my very poor translation that it's about a hunting society.
The Jagd Gesellschaft. Gesellschaft is society, and yeah, Jägen means shape, yeah.
Okay, so it's like the hunting society. And in making this painting, we see both these artists' way of working. It's true to their way of working. And they perceive themselves as hunters, which is a kind of common thematic in a lot of German romantic painting. And also there's a tree in the centre in which they painted their initials, as if they were carved into the tree. This is Georgie Hopton and Gary Hume. And Georgie Hopton's ceramics, which are these very beautiful flowers. And Gary Hume's paintings being emblematic of her work. So it's like his work, but the imagery derives from her work. Ray Barry and Mary Kelly, How to Build a Bomb Shelter at Home. Now this idea, I think, is fascinating in terms of relationship, that the couple might be active together in protecting something. The home and the act of building, making a home, but also making a kind of protection or privacy between the two of them. And there's this sense of this being made up of many parts, and quite often in Mary Kelly's work there's this idea of duration and things being built up over time and repetition. Sam Durant and Anna Pravacci. This is a quote from Anna Pravacci: when things go wrong, to me, is the most interesting. It's when you really, truly bond with someone. When you're in control, it's not that interesting. And these are baby wipes that are in a kind of container that you can take away with you. And they're called history wipes. And again, there's this idea that, you know, in being together, the materials of the household or the materials of kind of cleaning, and in this case, sort of a baby, which is a product of a relationship, and this idea of cleaning and wiping, and not only the history of them being together in this domestic space, but also that history is constructed and history can be erased, it can be forgotten as well as remembered. Okay, so this one for me is maybe not the most interesting artwork, but the most interesting as a kind of anecdote in relation to art. This is Anthony Gormley and Vicken Parsons, and the piece of work is called Relational Aesthetics, which I personally find a slightly trite title because it refers to the Bourriaud book, which is called Relational Aesthetics, which is a book about how an artwork could be an exchange. So it could be something which is, it doesn't have an object. It could be just, you know, something that happens, like an event or a meal or something as an exchange rather than object. And this is a mobile which is based on the different heights of the two artists, who are very different in height. And why this interests me is because in talking about this piece of work, Vicken Parsons said, well, I'm not actually that interested in that piece of work because it's not actually my work. It's a collaboration and it's not like my work. It's not a part of my work. This is an image of her work. And I find that really fascinating, that this attachment to one's own work and what might be given over in collaborating could be a problematic, and I don't want to sort of tie things too tightly as if they all belong to each other, but this idea of a relationship being something that you felt you had a really invested part in, and if you didn't, then you might dissociate yourself from it. I think those two are comparable situations. Okay, so this is Dorothy Iannone, and this is called the Icelandic Saga. Now, the Icelandic Saga is lots and lots and lots of pages of text and writing, which is a very detailed account of Dorothy Iannone's relationship with another artist called Dieter Roth. And he was based in Iceland. Dorothy was married to someone else. They went on a boat to Iceland to meet Dieter, and as soon as she saw him, she fell in love with him. And then it ended up that they got together. Her husband went back to New York on his own without her, and she and Dieter spent the next 7 years in a relationship together. And she wasn't trained as an artist. She's a writer. But her artwork has this kind of very naive look about the drawings, but it's also a very kind of direct language, so it sort of seems to not worry too much about what things look like, but just get the message down. And it's very there's a lot of it. It's very descriptive. But what's interesting about it is that it was written in several parts, and they were about 15 years after the relationship, 20 years after the relationship. So the translation of the relationship, because it as a thing became mythic, because Dieter Roth is so well known as an artist, it became a kind of mythic thing. That it's interesting that the space between the relationship and the artwork kind of makes the relationship into something much more mythic, much more of a story, much more of a myth, of a saga, than it might be if she was writing about it like a diary. Okay, so you can't really, I guess, talk about artists as collaborators and in relationships without mentioning Marina Abramović and Ule. And here's a kind of number of their performances. Just want to make sure that I give you. Sorry. So the performances are based on. This one at the bottom here, where they're kissing, is from 1977. It's called "Breathing Out, Breathing In," and so they're kissing together, but they're exchanging oxygen. So they're trying to breathe while they're kissing, and eventually, you know, they'll be breathing each other's carbon dioxide, and then they'll be killing each other. And there's a microphone attached to their throat, so you can hear that they're breathing. And the one from 1980 at the top there on the left is, you know, they're poised in relation to each other, and if they let go, they lose the tension that they're holding, then Ule will kill Marina. And they have a microphone attached to their breast so that you can hear their hearts beating and their heartbeat accelerating as presumably the tension is altering. Other performances, but this one is their last performance together, where they're at the Great Wall of China, and they start at different ends and they walk together to meet each other. And when they meet each other, they embrace, and that's the last embrace, because they're ending their relationship. And Marina says, "This is, you know, this breaks my heart," and it's like the most heartbreaking moment. So then, many years later, Ule and Marina have kind of moved into this sort of mythology of art collaborations that were. Marina was doing The Artist Is Present, which it was also at the Serpentine. You might have seen it in the summer. But this is in MoMA. And what happens is she sits in a room, and you sit, and you, as the audience, sit opposite her, and you just look at each other. And Ule is, in this case, the person who's sitting opposite her, and at the end of their time together, they hold hands. So, Gilbert and George, who, again, a couple who've been together for years and years and years collaborating, and what I think is interesting about their work is that I think it's almost an assault on the viewer. It's an idea of you're being confronted by things that you might find distasteful. You're being confronted by things that are meant to be an attack on you. But they're all things from that exist in the world, and they're all things from other places. Quite often they've used tabloid newspaper headlines. over images of themselves. And if you read those headlines out of context, they just look like, you know, horrible assaults. And in this case, the image of them together and them naked and them as lovers are kind of put together with images which are potentially repulsive. And there were questions, a kind of moral stance on what is agreeable, what is romantic, what is deemed good, and what is disagreeable, what is repulsive. Okay, this is another exhibition which deals with love, and it's opened last night. It's in Munich, and it's called Another Normal Love. So it's the work of Louise Bourgeois, Maria Lasnig, and Nancy Spiro. Louise Bourgeois, whose work I'm pretty sure you're all quite familiar with, there's a sense that love is a huge subject for her in her work, but there's also an understanding that that love is based in a personal psychology, which means that it's inflected by the tangles of relationships that she's been involved with through her parents, through different people that she's been with or loved, and with herself. So there's a piece there that says, to unravel torment, you must begin somewhere. Louise Bourgeois says, I'm not searching for an identity, I have too much identity. And the thing about these, not only these three artists, but these artists, is that their work became very visible because artists were aligned with or part of feminism, and their work was understood in relation to feminism. And Kirsten Stakemeyer talks about this issue, that feminism made them visible because feminism attempted to deprivatize women's lives in society. So there is an issue for women, I think, in making work about their personal relationships, that they sit within a space which is carved out for them, which is this space of being understood through feminism. And it can be problematic because it can be pigeonholing. It can be a way of pushing greater themes to one side. And that's just a kind of thing that I'm picking up from Kirsten Stakemeyer. And I think that that is a really big issue in relation to contemporary artwork that deals with intimacy. I just wanted to show a bit more of this piece by Nancy Spiro. Nancy Spiro made this piece called Cri de Coeur, and it was made after her husband died. Her husband was Leon Golub, who's a very famous American artist. Nancy Spiro's work is about the liberation of the female body from its function as a decorative element in cultural history. So she takes these kind of images of women throughout cultural history and activates them throughout the space so that they're doing other things, so they're very active. And this is like a group from an Egyptian frieze. And they go around the bottom of the room and they kind of get darker and lighter, so there's like a wave, and it's like a wave of grief or a wave of emotion, and these women are active in demonstrating their grief, which I think actually is really powerful. Okay, I'm trying to speed up now. Patricia Cronin, Memorial to a Marriage. Now, what's interesting about using something as subject matter which is personal, this is Patricia Cronin and her partner, is that at the time of its making, there wasn't same-sex marriage. So this is really a kind of protest against the fact that these women weren't allowed to marry or legally be together. So this piece of work was made, and it still is, in Woodland Lawn Cemetery in the Bronx. And it sits as a monument to marriage. And it was described as 2002, when it was made, to eternity, as if this would always be like this. But obviously now there is same-sex marriage. So in a way it sits in that cemetery as a kind of historicized problem. And in a way some artworks that deal with love really are just revealing cultural structures. So this, for example, if you didn't see the Benetton adverts at the time of its making, then you wouldn't necessarily know how this unpicks the kind of cultural capital that's used for advertising. So the Benetton advert was people of different races kissing each other. The Grand Fury piece is people of the same gender or different genders kissing each other. Okay, now I just wanted to describe something about a kiss. I'm going to move from couples to kissing now, and then I'll end. This is a piece by Hito Stale, and Hito Stale describes a kiss as something which is an exchange which might move from cheek to cheek, from mouth to mouth. And this idea of a kiss is a kind of strange idea. It's quite interesting, about a kiss not being an isolated event, but as a thing passed on. This is a piece of work which is about the Bosnian War, and about an event in the Bosnian War when 20 people got kidnapped from a train, and 19 of those people were accounted for. They all, as far as it's known, they all died. But 20 of those people were accounted for by, you know, they were researched, and they found out who these 19 people out of 20 were. And then there was one person who wasn't accounted for, who only three eyewitness accounts could verify that this person was on the train with the others. Because this person was a black person, a black man, and he got off the train with the other 20 people, and one of the soldiers who were kidnapping them tapped him on the shoulder and kissed him. And there are three separate eyewitness accounts of this, but no actual evidence of this person or who this person was. And in a way, that in that kind of story, anecdotal telling, this person becomes, they sort of take on a maybe sort of strange, ghostly, angelic type of personality or persona. But what Hito Stale has done for the piece of work is to gather together all of the information that she can. There are videos of people who are eyewitnesses or recounting eyewitness accounts. There's video footage of the place. There's a model to reconstruct the time scale. And it's a way that something like a kiss can become something that unravels history. Okay, just and just to say briefly about this, that still, even though the image which was from the Benetton advert and Patricia Cronin's piece become outdated or outmoded, there are still issues to do with love and whether loving is accepted in society that drive artists to make their artwork and make it about these very personal subjects. And I've just got two things I want to show you, if you let me. I want to briefly show you this clip from Cinema Paradiso. Film, then I feel like I'm ruining it for you. But it's all right, we can finish it then. Yeah, it's only that little bit really we want to see. Thank you. You can watch it afterwards, we play the whole thing. Okay, so I just want to go back to what I was saying about Alain Badiou, that Badiou says love is a unique trust based in chance. It takes us into key areas of the experience of what is different. And this idea of love as universal is... I need to play that in a minute. That's another clip. This idea that love is universal is maybe... It could be embodied by maybe that clip that we've just seen of from Cinema Paradiso by Giuseppe Tornatore. For those of you that don't know the film, the film is about a film director, Salvatore De Vita, who is fascinated by the projectionist, by the cinema. And so he helps the projectionist, and the films are censored by... There's a priest who rings a bell whenever a piece like that, a kiss, comes up. So that all of these parts are cut out of the films. And then the boy, as a boy, he keeps all these clips and he keeps them in a tin. And then he becomes this very famous film director, and when he returns home to his hometown, he finds the tin of clips and he asks his editor to edit them all together as one long sequence of kisses, which is what we've just seen. And it's really kind of quite beautiful because it's very emblematic, and also there's something powerful in that exchange. There's something that we can invest in our looking, in that kind of heightened moment of exchange. But I just want to now play this clip, if we can get it, because I want to, I'll show you and then you'll see what... This is another artist's work. This is Dewiwa, and she made these interviews with Africans. So it's asking about love, it's asking about intimacy. I just want to show a little bit of this. It should be... Oh, that's weird. I wonder if we can... Yeah. Huh. Okay, all right. Well, just to save time, I think I just have to paraphrase what happens. It's a shame you can't see it yourselves. There are African people talking, being interviewed about... love, different attitudes to love, different attitudes. No, that's not it. It's eaten by the heart. We can have it. No, okay, not to worry. I'll explain it. It won't be as good, but maybe you can go home and look at it. So people are being interviewed. Sometimes they're on their own, sometimes they're in couples, and they're being asked different questions about love and intimacy. And the interviewer asks, how do Africans kiss? And actually, I would so much prefer if it wasn't me, a white Western woman, saying this, because it's better when you see it as Africans talking about themselves. She says, how do Africans kiss? And one of the interviewees, who's a man, says, very badly, because it's not in our culture. It's not in our culture to kiss. We don't kiss each other. And other people have said, well, we don't really kiss. I mean, we don't kiss. And then he says, the first time I kissed in America, and it was like a French kiss, I felt repulsed. And his words are, I thought, what's this meat in my mouth? And I didn't like it, and I had to get used to it. And there's this description among the people that we were going to look at, that this idea of the kiss, and in fact, if we think about the Cinema Paradiso, the idea that this is a universal thing. Actually, what I'm going to say is, looking at this artist's artwork, revealed to me is not at all a universal thing. It's a very culturally constructed thing. And one of the things that artwork can enable us to do is to confront these types of standard ideas about, you know, how things operate. It can allow us to unpick through indirect means some of the things that we believe to be true. So, I mean, it's a shame you didn't see it, but maybe you can look it up. It's really fascinating, this, you know, altering of our perceptions of universality. Okay, that's about it. Thank you.
Remaining in the same place. What lends pliability to reality, she claims, as Freud did decades earlier, is taking the time to talk with one another without any predetermined purpose, without hurrying from one topic to another, without seeking solutions, and without skirting the real difficulty of actually communicating with one another. It is here that the continuing value of Freud's discovery asserts itself. Winnicott talked about the experience of just being with a baby, being and breathing. However, in the world at the moment, which is sort of dominated by distractions of one sort or another, this quest for distraction has reached epidemic proportions in the market economy, where the commodification of human experience has replaced human attachment. And this manifests itself in the consulting room. And I've noticed this. I've been practicing as an analyst now for 25 years. And I've noticed how the patients coming into the consulting room are dominated by a preoccupation with things rather than people. People looking for quick fixes and short-term treatments put the pressure on the therapist to either collude, as with current fashionable treatments, bit of politics there, or to provide the first frightening experiences of unstructured thought, negative capability, not grasping after fact, as John Keats wonderfully said. The first experience of unstructured thought being in an otherwise action-based world. This reminds me of John Rivers, the psychiatrist in the wonderful Regeneration trilogy, fantastic book, who worked with war survivors. And at some point he had a dream where he realized that the people he was working with weren't just soldiers to be sent back to the front. They were human beings. Okay? And the dream was he was bleeding himself in the dream. He discovered his humanity. Narcissism, primary narcissism, like the love that we all have for our children. And there was a song on the radio on the way over here. It was a bastardization of Sting's song, "I Hope the Russians Love Their Children Too." And it was a rather dark song, which was about, "I hope ISIS loved their children too." Okay. Not sure if that one works quite as well. But narcissism is a fundamental battle for us all. The quest between our intense preoccupation with ourselves and things versus the need to reach out to the other. When the balance between the relationship with the self in the external world gets out of kilter, one of the consequences can be an enormous preoccupation with the broken self. Okay. Freud, writing one of his most important papers on narcissism, explored the self-love which human beings need when they're born. It leads them to treat their primary carers, be their parents or in old-fashioned tense, nannies or serfs, to supply their every need. Narcissism is a necessary form of love. And Freud argued because, as is now understood, human beings are born too early. A current theory in evolutionary biology suggests that we have to be born long before we're able to look after ourselves so that our oversized heads can navigate the birth canal. Dogs and cats, dolphins and apes do not face such difficulties, so become independent relatively speedily. As infants, and then also youths, if you've had adolescence, we demand parental servitude, not for weeks and months, but years, his or her majesty the baby. Narcissism, primary narcissism, is then the first form of love. It's the rocket fuel for later life, like in that song, I think, of a wonderful love of a mother for her child. The myth of Narcissus tells of a beautiful young man whose problem was not that he loved himself, but he couldn't love himself. In the story, he catches sight of himself in the forest pool and becomes transfixed by the image. The still water reflects back at him. However, as he came closer to the face, and the face came closer to him, it disappeared at the moment their lips might have touched. As he reached out to hold his body, the lovely form of himself dissolved in ripples of water. Ted Hughes brilliantly translates this crucial section in Ovid's Metamorphoses, saying, "Not recognizing himself, he wanted only himself." This child in the myth, then, had not learned to know himself as he was and know that he was loved as he was. He had not developed the kind of narcissism that allowed him to feel comfortable in his own skin and at ease with himself. Aristotle picked up the theme, explaining that good self-love is vital for intimacy. Because I think narcissism gets a bad name sometimes. Okay. For one thing, he noted, if you cannot befriend yourself, warts and all, then how can you possibly expect to befriend anyone else, warts and all? After all, you are closer to yourself than anyone else. I remember myself as a teenager feeling anxious when meeting new people. Looking back, I can now see that the difficulty wasn't the new people. It was more that I was a stranger to myself. Slightly less now, I think. a thing. I like to think, anyway. So taking the risk to love others is the crucial step in the world, perhaps second only to the risk of allowing others to love us. On the whole, it's worth it. It makes for life in all its fullness. Psychoanalysts, though, spend an awful lot of time working with people who haven't actually have felt that sort of love in that song, Primary Love. And they bring to the analysts their experience of loneliness. I think one of the biggest experiences I've had on Valentine's Day, Christmas Day, people spending time on their own on bank holiday, is loneliness, the awfulness of loneliness. And the analyst is sometimes the first person that can begin to try and actually engage with that terrible loneliness, which is probably one of the worst experiences in the world. Somebody perhaps who never experienced what the baby in that song is experiencing. So I'm going to talk today about the difficulties of managing countertransference experiences when working with patients whose grasp on life and love is extremely tenuous, who haven't had the primary experience in the song, and unconsciously enact and provoke enormous concerns, or need to provoke enormous concerns, particularly for themselves, their family, and in their analyst, about whether it's possible or worthwhile to live in the shadow of death. They haven't had enough life to get them away from death or the fear of it. I draw on and discuss the three facts of life as originally proposed and developed by Roger Mundy Curl, a philosopher and a psychoanalyst. He wrote in 71 that he found it useful to consider three core facts of life, which are the recognition of the breast as a good object, the recognition of the parents' intercourse as a creative act, and the recognition of the inevitability of time, and ultimately the worst one of all from my perspective at the moment, death. He went on to say about this third fact that to fear death is not the same as to recognize its inevitability, which is a fact forced on us much against our will by the repeated experience that no good or bad experience can ever last forever, unfortunately. Or in the case of a bad experience, fortunately. A fact perhaps that none of us ever really fully accept. In my experience, I have found, as Mernie Curl argues, that we all work unconsciously to distort and blunt our acceptance of these profound human experiences. But I argue in addition that traumatic events may destine some patients unconsciously to devote all their efforts to subvert the recognition of these facts as an activity in place of living and loving, the perverse defense in a way. As fundamental schematics of the human experience, these facts belong to us all, not just our patients. My work leads me to believe that it is the process of the analyst bearing to face these facts fresh for themselves, whilst bombarded with death, fear, and resistance in the transience, that may begin to allow inklings of digested realization to be taken in by the patients. As analysts, we're narcissistic. You know, we like to see our patients get better because it makes us feel good about ourselves. As one of my drug addict patients once said to me, I'm not going to give you the fix you need as an analyst, you know. You analysts get high on feeling good about yourselves because you get when we get better, so I'm not going to. Which was an exploration, really, that did I have any other resources other than my narcissistic fix for my patients getting better for my wonderful work? Did I have other resources than her? Which her manic depressive mother, who she was an antidepressant to, didn't. However poor our experiences may have been, we must have all had some experience of nurturing. And we were all the products of a procreative union that made us, but inevitably excluded us. We have lost the breast and struggled to refine it. And we all fear exclusion, and ultimately the exclusion that comes through death. The ultimate narcissistic wound, really. The world goes on without us. It's only perhaps as we grope our way to understanding that good and nurturing experiences are all transient in reality, but must be kept alive psychically, that any of us are able to experience hope and love for ourselves and love for others. The patient I'm going to talk about now had traumatic experiences in the realm of death that left the capacity to manage the fear of loss of love and death disabled. She couldn't bear to love because to love means loss. You know, the more you love somebody, the more tragic it is if you lose them. And how any of us come to terms with that sort of awful conflict? I think we all use splitting in denial, really. You know, you leave your kids at school for the first time at 4 and a half with complete strangers, most of whom haven't been analyzed, you know. and you don't see them again for 6 or 7 hours. And to get through that, I think you have to employ some some splitting and sort of percentages and do some sort of thing in your mind and not think about it too much. With these patients, I fear myself to be disabled at times. It's hard to love them, actually. I think that early experience of not having that primary experience in the song, which is so beautiful, I think, and sentimental, of course, but I'm Welsh, so they are. They haven't had these experiences, and I was forced to live as they had done, with visions of the empty chasm, the empty void that many of these people distract themselves from because they feel there's nothing there. There is no love. I try to show how I think my countertrans has developed and how understanding it, in consideration of my patients' unconscious fantasies, played its part in enabling me to provide a more or less adequate container for my patient's shattered projections, which enabled her to begin to think and feel about these facts of life and begin to love as she'd never dared to before. And this is where love in analysis really begins to mean something. Okay, you have to find the love in yourself to manage to find somebody else's baby and their poo and their shit and their wee and their pain and their fear and anxiety in your mind in a positive way so they can begin to internalize something that perhaps they've not been able to internalize before. I think this dynamic is part of working with many patients with perverse and addicted defenses who fill up the black holes in their psyche by destroying any knowledge of the need for the other, by creating triangular relationship with substances and or perversion of one sort or another, creating loss and pain in their objects, the people they are with, while pursuing preoccupations that fill their minds and bodies with desire, whilst the real person is excluded and diminished. And this often leads to abandonment and loneliness, because few people would want to bear this sort of thing. Dr. L, my patient, was a bright... I've had permission, by the way, to use this clinical material. She's now actually in another country, gone back home to the country she came from, happily. Dr. L was a bright and reasonably successful doctor who was referred from a local teaching hospital, which she'd been taken herself with self-diagnosed ME. She had become depressed and incapacitated in her work, socially isolated within the confines of her flat, and she was terribly, terribly lonely. I think she's probably one of the loneliest people I've ever met. She had tried to cope with the situation by becoming more involved with her work, but felt unable to continue without help. The intellectual defenses she had employed to get on and be successful in her life, so far including migrating from another country, which I'm always really impressed by, learning a completely new language, which I'm extremely impressed by, still struggling with English myself, and excelling in exams were beginning to fail her. She had also begun to seriously lose weight, disappear, I felt. My first thought when I saw her was she looked like death warmed up. She informed me she had recently begun to frighten herself whilst alone in her flat at night by attacking her mind in such a way that she was having hallucinations of her mother's rotten corpse in the back garden, looking in through the window at her. She also imagined black birds flying through her flat. This felt both genuine and heartfelt, but was accompanied by a memory of wanting to jump into her mother's grave after her premature death. In this melodramatic account of her state of mind, it was possible to see both real feelings of pain and loneliness, but also evidence of her exciting herself with florid, morbid imagery and fantasies. One way of keeping yourself alive in a world that feels dead is to get excited by the one thing you've got lots of, pain or death, or something of that sort. I felt an inner deathliness was in danger of taking her over. And despite my instant reaction of alarm, I did not feel very loving towards this patient. About her weakened state and the hopelessness about her, we began analysis. She was not from this country. She was the fourth child in a family of seven. Her mother developed breast cancer very early on in her childhood. And this involved her being away for extensive treatments in the city, some distance from the family home. Dr. L remembered her mother coming home without her hair after chemo and radiation therapy. Her mother's anxiety for her children seemed to lead her, as many do, to emphasize the need for her children to get on and make the most of her academic prowess. If she was going to die, at least she could give them intellectual capacities with which to do something with later on. There was a strong family history of cancer, and there have been several deaths. So loving this family, keeping some hope alive, was extremely difficult. It was a feature of the early months that Dr. L had many colds and flu, which seemed to catch easily and hold on to. She always looked cold and weak, as if she needed to wear more clothes, which invoked in me an interesting state of mind, one of exasperation and rage at her helplessness. rather the concern or sensitivity about her self-neglect, which might more ordinarily have affected me with other patients. There wasn't much love, you know, inside of me for this patient. I often felt like telling her briskly, I didn't, but that she seemed to be making herself deliberately appear to be helpless to get me to look after her, but that this wouldn't work. In time, I came to understand these early countertransference feelings of mine were projected enactments of a relationship with a mother who simply had no capacity to take care of herself and who wanted my patient to take care of herself. I found Dr. L's sessions draining, as presumably Dr. L's mother had found looking after her family draining when she needed to be looked after herself. So the breakdown of that primary relationship. At the age of 11, Dr. L was sent to religious boarding school following the footsteps of her three older sister, the pursuit of academic prowess. Throughout her time there, she did well academically, whilst at the same time managing to be rebellious, some life breaking through the institutionalization. She would often adopt the mannerisms of a tomboy. I later discovered she had also suffered from a nocturnal enuresis, and although I did not know it, her fear of incontinence, both real and imagined, continued well into her adult life and through the beginning of her analysis, becoming very confused at her sexuality and search for love. Who could love me, the disgusting baby who wets her bed? Her mother eventually succumbed to a very painful version of cancer when Dr. L was 20. This was closely followed by her father's death only 6 months later of liver cancer. Father's role in the family was fairly sketchy, but he seemed he couldn't survive mother's death, and his cancer developed quite suddenly after her death. Dr. L responded to the death of her parents by working hard academically and doing what lots of us do, training as a helper, which is always a good manic defense against loss in one's own life. Training as a doctor. She had tried to find sexual partners all her life. She was desperate for love, but no serious relationships had materialized. She's one of those patients who every time she meets a partner, you feel like their mother, and you think, oh, yes, you know, she's married. She's met somebody really nice, a theater director once, and somebody who was in therapy the next time, but they all fizzled out. There was no chance of love staying with her somehow. It just fizzled away. Dr. L's history showed very considerable emotional privation and had clearly been a divorce between her work self and her emotions. One way of surviving in the world is to split. Okay, there's not enough love to go around. Develop one part of your personality and hope at some later date, if you freeze off another part of you, you might get help for that, which is what analysis does, I think. It was significant that Dr. L's enuresis began at boarding school, where it's likely that a sense of emotional isolation might have been reawakened by having been sent away from home to a loveless institution. I think patients I've seen from boarding school have developed a carapace because quite often when they're extremely vulnerable, the institution doesn't respond to their vulnerability. You have to survive, which is what she did. But now there was a regression to incontinence, which was her longing to be contained at some level. In her second session, she told me that in her view, she'd been able to conceive of getting help from me and continuing to work as a doctor, which is unfortunate because we like, one of our things about being an analyst, you do like to be paid. It's an odd sort of relationship. But our narcissism is gratified to some extent that patients pay us for our work. So I immediately was struck by the fact I might have a patient who couldn't pay me, which sort of hit me in the place, you know, it's like a vulnerable space, as it were. She'd been looking at advertisements to become a street cleaner for her local borough. I felt this fantasy of cleaning up other people's effluvia evolved from an unconscious fantasy that she could receive her dead parents, revive her dead parents, becoming closer to death-like state herself. She was also very identified at the time, she told me later on, with Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, when he had his breakdown, became a hospital porter working with dead people, a mortuary attendant. She posed a dilemma, as I did think it was reasonable for her to consider not working in medicine while she was clearly in such a vulnerable state. On the other hand, she had no financial cushion to fall back on. Her alternative job choice was evidently dangerous, as it was then the middle of winter, and her current physical health was extremely fragile. So I was like, looking after somebody who's extremely vulnerable. I was confronted immediately by my reactions to her depleted mental and physical states. At this time, I was torn between feeling rather angry, having to try to sort this immediate dilemma, and reluctant pity for Dr. L., and a sense that I didn't want to have to think about any of this. It was rather exhausting, actually. I gradually began to realize that Dr. L was insistently bringing the reality of death and deadly states into my room, and I didn't want to think about these any more than she did, consciously. to manage this first dilemma of life and death, the sort of really developmentally to some extent, how do I look after this very vulnerable woman? I could only fall back on my theory and the setting. And like her mother, I also had health, which was extremely important at the time. I was in no position to make decisions for Dr. L. My task was just to try and see how she responded to our working together. I was also, in my counter transience, very sort of affected by how much ambivalence I felt towards her. You know, she was an extremely vulnerable woman. And why didn't I feel more love or, you know, positive feelings towards her? I said to her at the time that she seemed to find it difficult to conceive of both getting help and helping herself. It seemed there had to be one thing or the other. I came to see this as a reenactment. This is much later on, applying the retroscope, which all analysts can do when they write papers. Okay, but at the time, you're struggling with it. But later on, I began to see this as a reenactment of being with a mother who could not help, who was too ill to help. Dr. L was forever tempted to regress to infantile dependency in order, I think, to try and find an object who had enough love and health and resources to depend upon. With great difficulty, to my relief, she continued to work. The pattern of her employment followed a similar path. She would often feel overburdened and expected to do too much. The first 2 years of analysis were extremely harrowing. It felt very difficult to keep something positive alive about this patient. So when I went to the waiting room, there was sometimes a relief she hadn't made it. Okay, I say that rather guiltily. Okay, and then I used to feel guilt afterwards, thinking, well, how can I do this for this patient? You know? I would also admit, I can do this now, I didn't admit it to my supervisor at the time, that I actually lent her £2 once for a parking meter. Okay, I've never done that with any other patient before. And I didn't tell anybody at the time, but I'm confessing it now. There was something about that moment. They brought in all these parking meters into Hampstead, and cars were being towed away left, right, and centre. And I just couldn't bear the idea, you know. And she actually literally had no money. It seemed I had to live with her within the anxiety that she might die. She was deeply depressed, always with a cold, had very little money, and was without any apparent social or family contacts, despite having a large family there abroad. The first dream she ever brought to analysis seemed to be a fairly accurate representation of her internal state. Whoops. I'm standing on the stage. I'm overlooking a swimming pool full of dead male bodies. They've all died due to some mysterious disease and seem to be floating in a urine-like substance. In the distance is a little boat coming towards me that is picking up the dead bodies. Her only association was it was deeply disturbing to be the only one alive in the sea of deadness. Dr. L was unable to think or say any more about this powerful dream, but I was able to use it to help me understand more about her. I felt more sympathetic somehow. I kept in mind that her urine seemed to be a negative version of the waters of the unconscious, dangerous waters in which you don't swim. I saw the male corpses as a symbol of her dead, frozen, disassociated emotions, especially her sexual feelings, which seemed to be annihilated by some deadly virus. That they were men seemed significant, given that I'm a man. I felt her identification with her dying mother had left her with the sense that she had a womb filled with something poisonous that could only produce deadness. The boat, I thought, might be seen as an ego, or the hope of a thinking ego that might develop, that might pick up. I understood her dead, frozen self. I wonder if I might partly be represented by the boat, but I was daunted and exhausted by the floating male corpses. This aid clearly came with the price of risk of very severe contamination, which in the countertrance I was dealing with, I used to get migraines and pains in my back and all sorts of stuff. It was quite very visceral at times. At the time, I interpreted that the dream to indicate her fear that her mind and thoughts would be lethal to anyone who came into contact with her, particularly men, including me. One aspect of Dr. L's dream presentations, and let's remember her initial morbid death hallucinations, was there often seemed to be some excitement in telling me in the dreams. A dream later in our work shows how Dr. L was beginning to use our work. I'm lying on a bed on the side of our partition, on the other side of which is a funny old nun on a trampoline who is jumping up and down, trying to see over me. See? By this time, we were able to think together about this view of a rather frustrated, possibly celibate person excitedly trying to reach her. Not a flattering image of me, I don't think. The nun seemed to be clearly to be a reference to her own celibate, perhaps childlike self. But it could also be an unflattering attack upon me, her analyst, a celibate, impotent person, which in this phase I often felt I was. We who could not ignore the manifest shape of the dreams, in which what someone was jumping up and down to see something, and the manner of dreams, this felt I was, Dr. L, becoming excited by being close to another human being. Very odd human being, I admit, who seemed at least interested to see her, even if she had to turn this man into an old nun, or herself, as she did at this time, into a sexless being. Some life, some couple, an odd, very odd couple, a sexless old nun, and sorry about nuns, but a sexless old nun and a rather sort of dead patient. Over time, when the Dr. L's confession of her urinary incontinence, her internal conception of herself as a lethal being began to merge. A lot of children, I think, whose parents die early, blame themselves. I have poisoned my mother. I would say she brought her dead pee in a deeply regressed state for the first time to someone who she hoped might convert it into thought. It was both aggressive and deeply defensive, so who might wish to be with such an incontinent child? A frightening cervical smear, of course, confirmed her worst fears about herself. We got through this. The facts of life were beginning to be managed. We can live, we can face death, and we can survive. And this later work urged upon us as an analytical couple the awareness of her sexual body and the difficulty she had in moving from an androgynous place where male and female are confused to beginnings of live sexuality and the beginnings of her having live company in the form of relationships. In my kind of transcendence, I had to negotiate not just the usual Oedipal feelings of recognized Dr. L's sexuality, but also respond to her increasingly desperate terror about losing me. If I come alive with you, how do I know you're not going to die? At times her fear for me joined with my own fear for me, and I would mirror Dr. L in finding thoughts about our mortality overwhelming. At times she experienced real terror, but if you talk about death, the inevitable happens. And it was of vital importance at these times that I was prepared to entertain the uncomfortable idea of my own death, my own limitations. If you care about somebody who's dependent upon you, you have to think about these possibilities. It's like, who do you have to look after your children if something happens to you on an aeroplane or something? You know? And this was an exploration of my capacity to cope with the thought of death and dying and keep something good alive without defensively interpreting this fear away or reassuring her or even worse, expiring on the spot. These questions about life and death became the focus of a great deal of exploration with me. How did I, an older man, live with the knowledge of my own mortality, a reasonable question for someone whose own objects seemed to have been dogged by and succumbed to such fears all her life? So this exploration of my capacity to cope with her streams of emotion about my death was an important ongoing aspect of her analysis. But I realized through this process, as she began to become more alive, I felt more warmly towards her. I would say I felt some love towards this patient. Okay? In fact, she's become one of the most important patients I've ever seen. As her ambivalence towards life abated, her fear that I would reject her increased. We could see this, perhaps, to quote early Freud, as hysterical misery through containment and thought and care turning to common unhappiness that we all have to live with. For this patient, and for these sorts of patients, the facts of life are intolerable. And like this beautiful song of the mother to her child, they haven't really experienced the mind able to think about them rather than succumb to the power of their infantile defenses or anxieties. This left them in the world where they could only enact through evacuating into others. In the case of Dr. L, in the concrete form of urine, pissing on everything. That was eventually, due to my countertransference and the wonderful setting that psychoanalysis creates, which I think is about love and containment, these thoughts about fear of death and disintegration became less frightening. These thoughts could become symbolized in the patient's own material, as in dreams. As a human being, I know that I too struggle at times to accept these three facts of life that Manikur sketched out 40 years ago. The tool that I make use of is of my belief in the analytical method, which I think has the capacity to keep something good alive when confronted by really painful experiences at the heart of it. That's what it's about. And that allows me to make some sense of violent and frightening counter-transfer experiences. If I bomb you with these things, can you, unlike me when I was in this situation, keep something good alive in you? Taking the risk to love others is a crucial step. But you do need to have this primary experience of being contained first. Otherwise, it's too threatening. And as I said, perhaps taking this crucial step to love others is second only to the risk of allowing others to love us. And I think she did make this step in her life. And I come back to this record. She had two children. She got married. She had two children. Happy ending, thank goodness. Although, of course, we've got the genetic thing hanging over us all the time. Can you really come alive with that sort of history? No. And the first child was about to be born, and I was on a holiday somewhere. And I got a phone call a week before her own child was born that her sister had died of cancer, which we knew she'd been ill. And I remember feeling absolutely furious with this dead sister. Couldn't you survive another week? You know? At the time, the baby in the womb turned around and became, breech baby. Yeah, so I had to have a cesarean. And I would say that child probably has had some issues. Okay. The second child was born normally, a son. Okay. And this time she'd moved back to the country that she came from. As a sort of celebration, I think, of that child being born, she found this record and she sent it to me. Okay. Okay. And what's the record about? It's about discovering that her internal child and her real child were lovable. Okay. Thank you.
If we could just take a couple of minutes then for questions, we've slightly gone over.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
But the people who need to leave to catch trains, then please do. When you were describing the patient, I was thinking of Louise Bourgeois.
Yeah.
Who had a very similar early life.
Yeah,
And just wondering, just to link up with Emma's paper, just wondering, you know, if she developed a creative...
Very interesting.
Would that have been a symptom?
That's
and how would that have contained, you know, and just thinking...
Louise Bourgeois had an analysis for a long time. I wrote a rather controversial paper that didn't go down that well, if you remember, at the Freud Museum.
Yes, I remember.
Louise Bourgeois, arty craft or crafty art, because I felt at some level she used her psychoanalysis and understanding in her work. That sometimes her work feels like an evacuation to me of something very primary. But I never know if she really worked it through in her own sort of therapy or analysis. You know. But it's very hard to say that about art, because you don't want to start psychoanalysis. Go on, say, please do. And I get a talk at the Coulthard exhibit at the Institute, and they're quite cross about it.
Well, I was going to say that Louise
wanted to maintain her psychological state, even though psychoanalysis offered this space for exploration.
Yeah.
She didn't want to alter her site. She wanted to be able to go back to these sites of pain as they were, to be able to pull from them to make artwork. And there's something about it not being an experience which alters.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, that's what artists are often frightened of, that analysis will spoil their creativity or limit it in some way. But I saw it when I came here and saw her work. It was so powerfully unconscious. The picture of the table with the father's bits all that had been vomited out by her family, you know, the father who may have sexually abused her and all that sort of stuff. And I did feel it was some enactment, I suppose. You know, when does art become an enactment, and when is it actually a symbolic representation? And keeping yourself in that state, what did that mean? You know, not using the analysis to necessarily work through something. Anyway, it didn't go down well before telling the student. So.
Maybe it means that there isn't a subject. The subject is different.
Yeah.
You know, it has to sort of stay as a subject that can be treated in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in what you were saying about art and writing, and I'm a writer, and I used to write more poetry and had some published, but the book I've just written is actually It's a sort of memoir by reference to paintings and psychoanalytic thoughts, musings, you know. And at one point I actually say I begin not to write. You know, and that's what I'm really interested in. But I'm terrified as well. I think, oh my God, is this the end now?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As one gets better.
Yes.
You know, that actually, but actually I think my writing's better for it. So.
Yeah, well, that's the difference. I think, I mean, I have seen people whose creativity is primary process. He won't mind me saying that. I saw a composer for a while, and whose music would seem to be mainly farting.
Yes.
There's really somebody come on stage and blow through a trumpet, but not making you for about 3 hours. So. And he did go through a period where his creativity disappeared, it seemed, and I felt very guilty, but something did re-emerge, which is less primary process. Now, you know, that's a value judgment, isn't it? What's wrong with farting through a trumpet? No. somebody once described Miles Davis as having this perpetually surprised look of a man who spent his life farting through a tube, you know.
Oh, no.
Which is not true. Miles Davis wasn't like that. But there's something about his music moved up from the lower levels to something a little bit more. But that's a value judgment. Who the hell am I to say? You know? And that's what came over with the Bourgeois paper. I was looking at it as an analyst. And it does seem to me that she's stuck in the same place over and over and over again. Vaginas with nails in them and penises being chopped off and fathers being vomited out. And I did think, you know, what was going on in her analysis? You know?
Or was that
a way of maintaining an equilibrium, which is absolutely fair enough. You know?
I think that's a little bit unfair on Louise Bourgeois. I mean, if you think about...
It was the work I saw here.
Just the range of her work and different materials she's using and the different, you know, and especially the textile works at the end and so on, the paintings, the pregnant women, the thick, you know. So there's such a range.
I was walking into the Freud Museum and seeing a large castrated penis on the couch, above the couch.
Yeah, that's... But Freud himself had a death mask at the end of the couch, so I was only trying to make a link between the death drive and castration context.
Oh, right. I didn't see that.
Yes. I don't know if you can tell, but I was just wondering the story you were telling over what period of time? What's the time span?
Well, I will have to confess at this point, okay. I still see her occasionally. what is that?
No, I was just making
a joke. Right. She's moved abroad, but every time she comes over to Britain, we still have a connection. I think it's partly to see that I'm still alive, which, you know, in my 50s was okay, but as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to get worried about it, because so many of her objects have actually died. You know? And you know, I have the omnipotent fantasy that psychoanalysis has helped her avoid cancer, and it does make one's immune system more robust, but whether it's robust enough to stand against the DNA is another question. You know? But I still live with the anxiety that the same thing will happen to her and her children that happened to her mother and two of her sisters now. You know? And I don't know. I don't know what it's like to live under that sort of threat. It's like the House of Usher, you know, that in the walls of the DNA, there's something, you know, that could get you. But as an analyst, you have to stay on the side of life, and stay on the side of the life instinct. And I think she's got much more, and she's full of life. And sending that music to me, which is also a transference communication as well. I know, you know, is about life, you know. And I just hope that the life she now feels engaged with will protect her from, you know, what her family struggle with so much. You know. But that may be that's a narcissistic view of psychoanalysis. You know. Or is it?
I want to ask a question about your narrative, because we had a long and somewhat trying, I don't say that critically,
critically.
Exposition of the impossibility of your situation. And then you said it's all as if you were swallowing it, and she got married and had two children, and then you went on. And I would like to have heard something about the transition, what led her to be able to do this.
Sure. There's a whole chapter in the book, which is coming out next week, so you can... I think we survived each other. and they survived each other. Gradually, I mean, it's really interesting. The boyfriend started off, she met somebody in therapy, but she turned to be a, he turned to be a criminal who was in therapy at the Portman Clinic. Then she met somebody who was a great man, a very sensitive man, but he turned out to be a transvestite who was more interested in dressing up in clothes than being with her. And gradually, her objects became less perverse and more, in a way, from my perspective, again, had more hope to them, you know, hopeful objects. And eventually married a musician, okay, and they make sweet music together, which is somehow, I can't go into it too much because of confidentiality, but somehow related to this piece of music, okay. And I think we found a rhythm of life together. But first of all, I had to live with, because, you know, I was quite young when I started singing, it was quite a long time ago. I had to live with my own fear that what I, my equipment that I had, so as it was, wouldn't be able to hold her. And she's one of my first patients.
Okay. So your survival helped her.
Absolutely.
Believe in life.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say to her sometimes, you know, she would say to me, at least I didn't engage with somebody who had one foot in the grave as an analyst. Although she knew that wasn't actually any reassurance because her parents had died young. But, you know, I think she actually benefited from my being one of my first patients. I wasn't as tired as I am these days. I didn't have a full practice.
Thank you.
So she got some real investment, I think. Yeah.
So is your connection continuing mostly because of your own fears, because of her
Thank
survival?
Thank you. Supervision. I need a bit of supervision.
Or because she actually needs it. And how will we know when this connection is coming to an end?
Absolutely.
How will you know when
tell
this
me,
connect-
tell me, please.
I don't know. I'm asking you.
It's very difficult. I care about her, obviously care about her deeply. She's got a life of her own now. She doesn't need me as much. I'll be quite honest, maybe I'm doing it for myself, my own need.
But yeah. Vaccine doesn't really harm anyone, does it?
I hope not. Without it, we've had it, really. And we do have a narcissist. I often say to patients, you don't really care about me, you do it for money. Yeah. Which is one of the most difficult questions in analysis. Because I do it partly for my own life and quite a good life I've had out of it, actually. Thank you very much, you know. It's as if that somehow or another, they cannot really believe that I have a part of my mind that is deeply involved with them. You think about seeing people 5 times a week. You are. How many times a week do you spend with your, hours a week do you actually spend with your real children like that? Intensively, without distraction. Well, much distraction. I did get distracted occasionally, obviously. But.
I thought it was interesting when you said that you felt like you, I'm paraphrasing, but you felt like you started to love her.
Yeah.
You started to feel something towards her when she was concerned about you dying.
Yeah.
I thought, well, that's a really interesting relationship for me, as, you know, outside of, I'm as an artist, I'm just sort of looking at it outside of knowledge. But I was thinking, that's really narcissistic, isn't it? That someone cares about you, so therefore you begin to love them.
Yeah.
Well, there's something invested in that.
But I think if you think of that song, which, I mean, I hope you really like that song. I heard it was, when I first heard it, it was incredibly moving. It was obviously the patient sending me something that meant something deeply to her, and about her second child that was a normal birth and everything. But I mean, I think that primary is love is a bit mixture of narcissism, isn't it? You're looking at something you've created. You feel like a god, you know. And there's something about being an analyst, possibly saving a patient's life, seeing her get better, finding love and having children, which I don't think she would have done without analysis, you know? Which is extremely gratifying at some level. You know? It doesn't happen that often, you know? Not in that way, anyway.
Yes, I just was thinking back to the discussion earlier about love and how much of it is altruism. Mm. And in the light of your story, I wondered if you could sort of think, tell us which parts, if any, of this relationship actually were altruism, which I'm not even sure, you know, frankly, I think that most of love is about getting something back. And when you look at what you went through at the beginning of this.
Yeah, I know the answer to that. See, think about being an analyst. You've had your own analysis, okay? And my analyst, I mean, I was a terrible patient, you know, in my view anyway. I think having had an object, my own mother probably, who put up with, well, not probably, obviously, sorry, mum, who put up with that sort of stuff for long enough, I did have something to fall back on inside my own resources
that actually tolerated the anxieties I created in people. So it's not, that's not narcissistic, I don't think. There's something about passing on something. If you've been given enough love, I think you do have enough to offer others. And it's a wonderful thing, you know, if you can get it either in your early experiences or from your own analysis. You know. Actually having someone to bear life and death with is the only antidote to the problem of living, you know. And I find loneliness in my patients unbearable at times. You know. It's probably more about me. You know.
I think maybe that can we put up with it, and you know, might be a good place to end. Yeah. Perhaps if, and can we survive it? Which we've survived today, so that's something. I think we should thank all the speakers. Thank you.